every Wednesday after 10 o'clock, we delve into the history of some of the more interesting stories in South Africa. We're more than just 1652. We're more than just a colonial and apartheid history. There are some very, very interesting stories that come out of this country that we call home. And we have a rich history of rock art, especially if you're going up the West Coast, up into the Cedarburg, a little bit inland round about Clan William. But not all rock art is ancient. Some of the rock art that we see around us also reflect the start of the settler colonial period in South Africa. And today in the history of, we're talking to researchers about how the story of some rock art tells the story of slave deserters and rebels who left the Cape, went into the hinterland. They became part of the indigenous Khoi and San tribes. And as we saw settler expansion into the hinterland, we saw the emergence of even a group of slave bandits and colonial outlaws. Joining me now on the line is Brent Sinclair Smith. He's a researcher at Wits University's Rock Art Research Institute. Brent, thanks so much for joining us here on the Morning Review.
Good morning, Lester. Thank you very much for having me here.
When I think of rock art, I think of age-old millenniums ago of Khoi and San and indigenous rock art in South Africa. But it could be as quote-unquote fresh as what, some 300, 350 years ago, telling really, really interesting stories.
Well, I mean, in some cases, some of the paintings are even younger than that. We're going back to, you know, perhaps 150 years, sort of in the mid-19th century. So that's like the 1850s period. And, I mean, how we know that it dates from these time periods is that we see images of people riding horses, holding muskets, wearing European-style hats that were obviously, you know, introduced by the colonists. Mm. And then reading that alongside the written colonial records as to where these groups were hiding out, in which areas, at which time. And that is how we are able to get these younger dates for these paintings. Mm.
So what does some of the research that you find, some of the rock art that you've uncovered, what does it tell us then about slave rebels and bandits and colonial era sort of outlaws that started emerging sort of 300, as you say, as close as 150 years ago?
Okay, well, I mean, first of all, is that it shows us that these groups were actually, you know, coming together at all. You know, and when we talk about slavery, I mean, on the one hand, we're referring to the slaves who were taken against their will and basically imported to the Cape through the East Indian Ocean slave trade. And on the other hand, there was also an illegal trade in Khoi and San. Now, when the colony was first founded, Jan van Riebeeck was told by the Dutch East India Company that he was not to enslave the local population. However, the farmers out on the frontiers, when I say farmers, I mean European farmers, of course, they had other ideas around this. And in many cases, they actively went out on commando and sought out San and Khoi, who they would capture and use as an illegal slave force. We know within the records that, you know, one of the ways of resisting slavery was to abscond or to escape, basically. And we find records as to where these groups escaped to. We know quite often that they were mixed groups. So you might have within a group somebody from, say a Malay, a San person, a Khoi person, you know, like very, very mixed. What is interesting is that, so basically one of their primary ways of rebelling was through stock theft. And we see paintings of people that are clearly taking livestock. So, you know, painting those sorts of concerns.
And it's quite fascinating that when we talk about the diversity of our communities in terms of the diversity of the DNA and the genetics that run through through South Africans' blood. If we're looking at Malay slaves, slaves from Malagasy, slaves from West Africa, you know, arriving at the Cape, then rebelling, moving up, trekking into parts of the country, joining with with traditional Khoi and San groups, maybe even Amakosa groups, even in the Eastern Cape, the diversity of our heritage, also speaking through those conversations.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, when you mention Amakosa groups, the Guna Khwebe in particular were renowned for housing runaway slaves. They were at, we're talking in the early 1800s here, they were the furthest west Xhosa chieftaincy. And so obviously they were one of the first groups that one would come across when escaping the colony. Mm. And yeah, they were renowned for absolutely housing runaway slaves and, you know, incorporating those people into their communities as well.
Mm. You were saying that theft and banditry was a form of rebellion. One could argue even a form of early political protest. What does some of the literature tell us about some of the colonial era slave rebels who then turned to banditry, particularly targeting, you know, farms of earlier settlers?
Okay, so I mean, for, you know, why they would typically turn to banditry? Like I said, they're escaping from the colony. Usually, they're taught. I'm sorry, they're treated absolutely terribly. I'm going to give an example of one man named Draguna, who we don't know whether he was exactly Khoi or San. He might have been a mixture of both. Mm. Now, Draguna, in the early 1820s, he was working probably under slave conditions, certainly under unfree labor conditions, on a farm near the Tarkastad area in the Eastern Cape. Mm. One day, Draguna was horribly beaten by his master. He was nearly killed, in fact. And once he was healed, he decided to get out of there and he headed off to the Karoo, where he started assembling a group that included other runaways. Certainly, we know slaves. We know people that were escaping from the colonial military, Khoi and San themselves, not colonists. And they then headed back to the Tarkastad area. And they one of their main sort of camps was up at the heads of the Mankazana River, which we since visited and found rock paintings there. From there, they basically started taking cattle and horses from the farms which they had previously worked on. And so on the one hand, the idea is trying to enrich themselves. On the other hand as well, it's also trying to, you know, get back at the colonists. Mm. The Tarka region is fascinating in that despite its, when we say sort of a frontier, one has this idea of the colony almost expanding constantly. This area, there were actually times when there was so much bandit activity there that the colonists were actually forced to flee back into the colony and actually give up the land there. So the frontier was kind of moving, you know, backwards and forwards almost. It was a hugely contested landscape.
I think it's absolutely fascinating that you can map, get a wider picture of that period using colonial documents, but at the same time using something that is as rudimentary but very, very narrative as a as an indigenous Khoi or San rock painting. But also must be quite fascinating looking at a rock painting and seeing something that looks quite familiar like a gun, quite familiar like a helmet or a hat, which is far closer to our period and our understanding and consciousness. That must be quite fascinating, seeing that and saying, well, that's actually a gun. And I wonder what emotions or images or thoughts that provokes in you.
Sure. Okay. So, I mean, on the one hand, yeah, that is fascinating seeing that. What for me gets particularly interesting is when you start seeing things that almost from a narrative view don't fit the picture. Mm-hmm. So we look at a painting and we see people on horseback with guns chasing cattle. And then we see a whole lot of baboons or ostriches in the painting as well. And we start looking to, okay, so what did these animals mean to these people? Now, within Cape San society, the baboon was an extremely powerful animal. It was associated with a type of medicine, a root called shoktoa. And the baboon would chew this root and it would alert to danger. Mm. It would know if danger was approaching. Also, if it was chewing this root and if you fired an arrow at it, it would be able to either catch the arrow and throw it back at you, or it would be able to avoid the arrow. Now, within times of warfare, or banditry for that matter, we see references to this root being used in much the same sort of way. And so there's kind of this association with sort of baboon power and through this root itself. Mm. The root could also be burnt. and point it at an enemy. And if that was done so, then they said that it would help disguise them away from the enemy. So in the same way that the baboon would use it for protection. And then on a slightly more sort of spiritual side of things as well, is that there was a strong belief in rainmaking and rain control. Mm. Now, it was believed that this root could be used to create either rain or a mist, okay? So if you're taking cattle, excuse me, and you call down rain, on the one hand, it washes away the cattle's hoof prints. And on the other hand, the mist that comes with the rain can also help disguise you from any commandos that are chasing after you, and you can escape successfully. So the baboon gets associated with sort of warfare, with stealth, with theft. And the fact that we're seeing that animal being painted amongst these images as well is highly suggested that they were calling on those sort of powers through the baboon and the medicine that it uses.
We're speaking to Brett Sinclair Thomas. He's part of Wits University's Rock Art Research Institute, telling a fascinating story of discovering and studying rock art that tells an actually very nearby history. Slavery and colonial settlement 350 years ago or so, in terms of our consciousness and the impact of what it has on modern South Africa, still actually very close compared to millennia of rock art found that could be dated back to millennia ago, telling us a story of how some of these pictures, some of these stories tell us a history or a story of slave bandits and colonial era outlaws, seeing pictures of guns and helmets being drawn on rock art and illustrated through rock art. There's a question that's come through, Brent, that asks, how has rock art managed to sustain, especially against the elements here in South Africa?
It's hugely dependable. To be honest, in many cases, it doesn't. We know that it's okay, typically, you know, they're painted in shelters and it's a shady shelter. So there's lots of shade. That is an ideal condition. Sun damage is one of the worst. So if it's painted more likely sort of on a cliff, it's less likely to last. Water damage, it does happen, but it's not as water's not as destructive as the sun, basically fading the paintings out completely. Now, the much earlier paintings were generally done with, we would actually say, a higher quality of pigment, in fact, painted in ochre, which was ground up very, very fine, and being painted on typically on Cape sandstone. The sandstone acts almost as a bit of a sponge, and it actually the paint actually sits within the rock itself. Whereas these later colonial era paintings, usually the pigment is of a much sort of a thicker quality, and the individual grains that go into the pigment are much coarser. And so instead of being absorbed into the rock face, it actually sits on top of the rock face. Which is one of the reasons why, strangely, in many cases, a painting that was done 200 years ago actually looks like in much worse condition than a painting that was done 3,000 years ago.
Why is it so difficult in South Africa to record some of these narratives? And we look at, particularly in the theme of colonial outlaws and bandits, and slave rebels who form very much a part of our history. And I think of the 1808 slave rebellion here in the Cape, Louis from Mauritius, leading a slave rebellion here in the Cape, which lasted for a short period of time, but was a show of political power. We look at other sort of colonial era outlaws that essentially get turned into myth, Nongolozo being one in the Transvaal. We don't often hear of these stories, these narratives of these very, very fascinating people who form just one part of the huge tapestry of South African narrative history.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, I think, you know, in general, most of the groups that I look at are generally very, very small scale. So, you know, they're not like the sort of the Louis von Mauritius who's leading 300 to 350 people. These are groups which are more likely consisting of, you know, a handful, not very many at all. I know I mentioned Raguna earlier. His group, I think at its largest, was around about 20 people. Later on in the mid-19th century, in the 1850s, there is another group that has been studied extensively by Sam Challis, who are based more up in the Underberg in KZN, the Amatola, who they get described as a nation, and it sounds like they might have had several hundred members. Mm. But for the most part, the groups that I'm looking at are generally, yeah, they're very small scale. They also, you know, Lester, the sad thing is that, you know, there weren't really many survivors from this. Mm. Again, I'm going back to Draguna just because I find him a fascinating character. His group is only active for 1 year before he's killed. Mm. So it's they get murdered very, very quickly, sadly. And that does mean that the legacy, I think, gets cut short quite quickly. As for why people haven't looked at this so much, like I said, I think that's just the very issue, is that these are small groups that weren't around for very long. And so it does take, you know, quite a bit of reading into the histories to actually find them. Nigel Penn at the University of Cape Town has done some fantastic work on very, very similar groups up around the Bokkeveld and the Roggeveld, sort of the Cederberg area.
We're running out of time, so I want to squeeze two questions into one idea. The first one is, the members of these groups who fled slavery, rebelled against slavery, became part of these banded outlaw groups, and you say that many of them don't actually survive that long, but I'm quite keen to know what other level of assimilation into indigenous groups they are that could still be found maybe in the genetic makeup of some people who are around today.
Yeah, of course, certainly. I mean, there's bound to be plenty of DNA within the genetic makeup. You know, I mean, of course, prior to escaping, what also is happening is that you would have, especially on settlers' farms, you've got the people who were enslaved overseas and moved here. And then, like I said, Khoi and Saan people who, as they lost their land during the colonial process, some of them were forced to find work on European settlers' farms. Others were, like I said, captured on these commandos and basically chain-ganged into working on the farms. And these people and so you've kind of got the illegal local slaves, if you will, and the imported foreigner legal slaves. Mm-hmm. But they would be living together. You know, and we know that they certainly had relationships together. We know that in many cases they actually escaped together. So that if you're looking for the DNA, I mean, that would certainly have continued throughout time and would absolutely still be present today.
Never enough time to cover these topics. But Brent Sinclair Thomas is of the research at Wits University's Rock Art Research Institute. Fascinating story about how the stories of slave bandits, of slave rebels, and colonial outlaws being recorded and told via some of these still existing San and Khoi rock art paintings that we see in many parts of this province. Brent, thanks so much for joining us here on The Morning Review.